The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, I like sitting here with you, meditating. I hope that you'll like it at least a teeny bit, 10% as much as I like it. I think we're in good shape. It's a wonderful thing just to sit and sit with other meditators. And so a little bit in appreciation of all that I would like to offer this talk. And I'll start with a Sufi story. And there's a character in the story named Mullah Nasruddin. And he's kind of a wise person. Some people say he's a wise fool. And it seems that there was a time when Mullah Nasruddin was smuggling. He was smuggling things across the border to another country. And the border guards didn't want him to smuggle because he was supposed to pay a toll, a tariff, to bring his things across to the other country. But they could never find anything. So he would come, and he'd come with his donkey, and he'd come up to the border, and they knew that he was smuggling. So they would search him all over, and, you know, everything they could, and look up and down his donkey, and they couldn't, you know, they couldn't see anything. And every day he would do the same thing, come with a donkey and come through, and they knew, and they could see. So one of the border guards lived near where Mullah Nasruddin lived. And so he could see that Mullah was getting richer and richer. What's this guy smuggling? So it went on for years and years. And then Mullah Nasruddin, you know, at some point he retired. He didn't have to work anymore. And so he stopped doing that border crossing. And so his neighbor, the border guard, said to him, you know, Mullah, we know you were smuggling. Now that you're no longer doing it, what was it you were smuggling? The donkey. Donkeys. So with these wisdom stories, you know, what's wise about this? So we have to make it wise. We have to interpret it in ways. And I love this story because as we go through life, we come across a lot of toll booths. And the tolls sometimes are really big and heavy for what we encounter in our life. And the toll, the people wanting the toll, they're there to, you know, get their due. But if you don't have anything, there's no toll. So the idea that you could go through life and get rich, maybe, not because you have donkey, but because you have nothing that the border guards, customs, cares about or wants. You have nothing. It, I think, relates very much to some of the core principles of Buddhism. That a lot of suffering we experience comes from wanting things and comes from having things. In particular, the thing that we have the most, that takes the most toll, the most expensive, is attachments, is things that we're holding on to. Not just simply having desires, but holding on to the desires or having aversions and holding on to them. And the border guards will see them. You can't slip by carrying a big bag of desire, a big bag of attachment, a big bag of aversion. Those border guards are really good. And it's going to take a big toll for you to go through carrying those as you go through life. Lots of them. The more desires, the more attachments you have, turns out, the more borders you have to cross. And the more toll you're going to have to pay. Pay with stress, pay with disappointment, pay with frustration, pay with all kinds of things, despair, all kinds of things that come along. So it turns out the way to fool the border guards is to go across with nothing. They'll look, they'll check you out, but there's nothing to have on you. And you can get through life a lot easier. So one of the teachings in Buddhism is that if you have desires, even appropriate desires, it agitates the mind. And it isn't a teaching that you should have no desires. That's impossible. But it is a teaching that at least once in your lifetime, you should go to the Buddhist Mecca. Just once. Go to the place where you stop having desires. Have a real experience of letting the desiring part of the mind rest and stop. And one of the results of meditation for many people is first to see how much their mind thinks. But if you look underneath what's driving the thinking, it's not too far away to analyze it as some kind of desire. We want something. Or it's a negative desire. We don't want something. And we're looking for something. We're trying to get something. We're trying to prove something. We want pleasure. We want comfort. We want all kinds of things. And some of the things we want, as I said, are quite appropriate. But some of the desires we have are pleasant to have. The hope that's in them, the expectation in them, the projections to the future that goes with them. Some of the negative desires we have, maybe they're not pleasant, but some people get pleasure from them. Sometimes being very judgmental and critical of other people, having hate, it kind of brings energy to people. They feel a sense of vitality and aliveness. They feel better than other people. And that can bring pleasure, a certain kind of satisfaction to people to have those things. However, it does keep the mind agitated, keeps the mind spinning. And so one thing in meditation, you start seeing how much it operates. And as the mind gets quieter, then only then do we start seeing the toll it takes. We often don't see the toll because we're so much in it. So, for example, with desires, we can have all kinds of thoughts, desirous thoughts, and they might be pleasant, what we're hoping for, the fantasies we have. There might be the pleasure or the satisfaction of hope that, this will happen, I'll get this, it'll be so great. And because there's some pleasure and hope and expectation that's kind of the momentum in it, it kind of is camouflaged from us. We don't really see its nature. We don't see the way in which the mind is being agitated and busy and spinning because we're kind of blinded by the pleasure or the hope that's in them. But if we can kind of switch the perspective and not be mesmerized by the desires, but see what's going on more deeply within us, the process of thinking, the process of desiring, you'll see that it's tiring, it's agitating, it keeps the mind busy and agitated. And maybe a few of you, I'll give you an analogy that I think is a modern analogy that certainly I have, and maybe some of you have as well. If you have had a nice, relaxed day, and maybe you've gone for a nice walk, you've had a nice nap, you've been with friends and had a nice conversations, and you feel pretty satisfied and settled and good, and good. You could, if you wanted to, sit and look out the window on FT for a while and be perfectly content. But then your device is next to you, your tablet. And so you pull it up. It's innocent enough to pull it up and look at it. And you start looking and you start looking and start looking. And one website goes to another website and you start checking things. And then you remember, you better check your email. And then you're back to the websites, and I have to check the news too, and I wonder what this news place is. And so after about an hour of kind of surfing the web, looking at all these things, you stop, and you look out the window. Uh-oh. You can feel, at least I do sometimes, I can feel the mind spinning and agitated. It's energized in a way that doesn't actually feel very good. Though while I was doing it, there is a kind of hope, this website will have something. This will be good. The hope, I'll just click on here. I'll read that email, because you hear the ping of the email and the serotonin buzzers go off and like, wow. and it's just a bill coming in. But you didn't know that. You didn't know that when you heard the ping, right? It's like, oh, it's so good. And so the idea is you can start, I think some of us can feel the cost, the toll that it took in the mind being energized and activated in a way that it wasn't before when it was settled. But it was camouflaged, or wasn't seen in the process of being on the device. Afterwards, we can feel, wow, look at that. My mind is very different. I sometimes joke that if most of us who are spending a lot of time on computers and devices could go back and get a 1960s mind, the contrast would be so great you would think you were enlightened. Because of the way the minds are sort of, you know, activated and busy and all that. So desire does that to us, that we, you know, it activates, and the cost of it, the toll, is hidden from us because we're so involved in it. Our thinking too, the cost and the toll of thinking incessantly and spinning, and sometimes it's kind of like being on the computer sometimes, and, you know, up and going. And the toll is invisible because we're so caught up in the content and the ideas and the hope and the pleasures and the fears and all of it. Meditation can teach us the toll. Meditation can teach us, wow, this is a lot of effort and work. It's exhausting for the mind to be desiring all the time. And then you can ask the question, what would it be like to have a mind that doesn't want anything in this moment? But not a mind that checks out, not a mind that goes numb or goes kind of blank, but a mind that's kind of luminous, clear, present, here, but is here, and you would be nowhere else when you have no desires. It's desires that take us away from the present moment. And so if you're able to put your desires to rest, you will be here. And if you're awake and clear in your attention, you'll be here, present for this experience. Is it worthwhile? Is it valuable? Is it valuable to get through to the next hour without having to pay all those tolls? The border guards won't notice you. When there's no... The Buddha said, basically, he said... He used a very different metaphor. He used the metaphor of a kind of a trickster, devilish kind of person called Mara. That Mara, if you have no desires, Mara can't find you, can't see you, and there's no toll. So to have the experience of having no desires, having no attachments, and having just being here in a simple, open-hearted, clear way is difficult to do. And what will happen for some people in the process of kind of coming close to that, there's a lot of protests the mind will do. One of the protests is that it's boring. You know, this is really boring. Boring is just another... Turns out that boredom is just another kind of tricky operation of desire. It's a desire that, you know, that wants you to keep wanting to desire more. You know, you want to stop being bored, so you desire something and something promising and everything. But boredom is an activity of the mind. It's not inherent in the mind itself. It's added to the mind by how we think and how we evaluate and how we judge situations. Nothing is inherently boring, except what the mind makes of it. So if we can let that boredom, if you have the courage to hang in there and let the boredom quiet down too, then we don't have the boredom problem. And then there can be the protest that, yes, but, fill in the blank, but then I won't, the important things won't happen in life. Then I'll just be a couch potato. Then no one will love me. Then I won't get rich and famous. Then I this, and this, and this. I better think. It's important things to think about. Gil doesn't seem to understand. He's like, you know, living as a Buddhist teacher for too long, you know, and what does he know, you know? But it's important to be, you know, it's important to think and have desires, and it's necessary to have every single one of them all the time. You know, they're important. My desires are important. or my fears are important, or what I'm trying to protect myself from is important, or what I'm trying to prove about myself is important, and it has to happen. I can't stop it. If I stop it, I won't exist. If I stop it, I won't be safe. If I stop it, there's no hope. And I'm living on hope because it's so despairing not to have it. Or if I stop desiring, then I have to sit with myself. And this, I'm not good company. There's a lot of pain here. There's a lot of anger or hostility. There's a lot of fear. There's a lot of difficult stuff here. So in the Buddhist analysis, all those difficulty, which we want to have a lot of respect and care and compassion for, it's not like, I don't want to make light of it. It's not easy. However, all of it, in one form or the other, represents having some kind of desire. Very subtle. Maybe desire is not quite the right word. Something we want. Something we're hoping for. So this idea of quieting the desires, quieting them, staying present for what's there, and it begins in this practice by allowing whatever is present without adding desires on top of it. So it comes to a point sometimes in practice, this gets a little funny, where you can't desire desirelessness. And that doesn't work either, exactly. But that's, it only happens at some point. If you're like, 10,000 desires a minute, wanting to be desireless is a fine thing to do. And you can get down to 1,000 a minute just by wanting to have less desires. So you can go in that direction, but sooner or later you have to kind of even give up the desire to have no desires. You have to just be willing to kind of sit with what's there. And if what's here inside is difficult, the reason you do a lot of thinking and desiring and wanting and not wanting is to protect yourself from feeling the discomfort in here. Sooner or later, if you really want to kind of drop into this good heart you have, you have to be willing to quiet the desires, become quiet, and be willing to feel it, feel what's there, without the constant operation of desires around it. There can be a metta desire that's got you going, which is to heal and resolve some of this inner difficulty. And that's what gets you to do it. But then as you do it, you have to know, now that I'm doing it, the time is just sit here with it, sit with it. And here's a little bit of a toll to pay, but this is a good toll. Because if you don't do this process of dropping down and working with some of the inner challenges, the border guards will take a much bigger toll other times. This is actually a minor cost to go through it, even though it can be quite difficult, but in the big picture. So to let the mind become quieter and quieter. Now, one of the important guides in all this, when it's in Buddhist terms, is that as we move this direction to having less, temporarily, don't worry, you don't have to argue with me saying, well, Gail, you have to have desires. Yes, I want you to have desires, the right desires. But there's a time and the place to allow them all come to rest. And then if they really come to rest, if you get to that Buddhist Mecca of really having no desires, you'll have a completely different relationship, a healthier relationship with the desires you have after that. No one's going to take away your capacity and value of having certain kinds of desires and living based on desires. That can't be taken away from you. So this is not so threatening what I'm asking you to do. I'm suggesting that it's valuable to do it temporarily, briefly, to touch that place where there's no desires and see who you are, see what it's like, see what life is like. It's a radical different perspective because the normal way that motivates desires is often a feeling of being inadequate, not having enough, being wrong, wanting something, wanting to be better, wanting to be better than others, wanting to prove oneself, all these things. that this underlies desire is painful. But if we can just go to that place where there's no desire, where that pain, that drive, that feeling of, there's no inadequacy there. There's no feeling worthless there. There's no feeling like you're not enough there. It's the opposite. We feel very much enough, very adequate, very present, very kind of, things are, you feel kind of, you become a wonderful person by not wanting to be. Isn't that great? Or is that too, is that like, you know, costs too much? So the guide in Buddhism, so as we can let go of our incessant desires and wanting and attachment, what we're looking for in Buddhism is that our suffering, the stress level that we live by, begins to decrease. Even just a little bit. And then what we're asked to do, what's helpful to do in this practice, is to begin to appreciate the decreased level of stress, of suffering, of despair, of sadness, of anger, of hostility. So to recognize the decrease of suffering, of stress that we have. And in Buddhism, that decrease is the North Star, is the guide forward. Go forward in the practice. Oh, this is the direction to go. And we're looking for the place where there's less and less suffering. And that becomes, you know, might sound like not a very great religious ideal to end up in a place where there's no suffering. Maybe it's not a very great religious ideal. But do this first. Don't suffer for the better ideals. Don't put up with your suffering for the better ideals. Maybe it's more like a basic good human thing to do, to learn to come to a place where you no longer feel suffering and stress and despair and anger and hostility and all these things. Wow, that's pretty amazing. And once you've done that, if you're still interested in other ideals, please, it could be great to do those things. In Buddhism, that is the highest ideal, to come to a place where there's no desire, to come to a place where there's no suffering. And the experience is one of the most satisfying, most rewarding experiences anybody could have. It's quite luminous. And it's an experience which turns us inside out. Because one of the protests that people have about this going in this direction of not suffering, going in the direction of having no desires, even just temporarily, is that it's very personal and it's internal. And so, you know, I'm supposed to help the world. You know, I don't want to just self-absorbed kind of practice here. In defense of this direction in life, most of the desires we have are self-absorbed. You know, so that to defend, you know, coming to, you know, letting go of desires when most of the desires are self-absorbed is kind of funny. But as we get into this place where we drop our desire, our attachments, then we get turned inside out. And the inside out means that our hearts, our capacity to be sensitive, to have empathy and compassion, is no longer kind of inside the rib cage, but is, you know, on the surface of our skin. And we're connected to the world in a very different way than if we're connected to the world through desires, connected to the world through all the thoughts and projections and judgments and commentary we have about what's out there. So to be turned inside out. So there was someone who came to me on Sunday and said, I wanted to ask a question, but I didn't, there wasn't time. And I said, when I meditate, I talk to myself about the meditation. I talk to myself and explain to myself as I meditate, this is what's happening now, this is the in-breath, this is the out-breath. And I said, yeah, sometimes I do that too, I said. I give myself instructions when I meditate. I said, okay, Gil, sit up straight. Okay, now tune into your breathing. What's that breath like? Oh, look at that, that's nice. And now, can I just feel that breath? You know, where does it, how does it move? And where's the tension? And where's the looseness? And so there's a little bit of talking. So this guy said, it's okay to do that. And I said to him, well, is it better than the alternative? And he said, oh, yes. If the alternative is worse. So if the mind is just thinking incessantly what business as usual, it might actually be work better to don't try to stop your thinking, just think in better ways. Think in kinder ways, supportive ways. Think about the practice. And, you know, it's not, you know, the pristine silent mind that something people think you're going to have. But if it's better than alternative, if it moves you in the direction of less suffering, moves you in the direction of more stillness, that's the guide. And then as you do it, then the mind stills and becomes quieter. Then at some point you say, I don't need to do this anymore. Or at some point, maybe I'm not getting any return anymore. So now maybe I should stop giving myself instruction. And now I just kind of stay with the breathing. Try to stay with the breathing in a calm way. And now just staying with the breathing is what helps the mind become stiller or to have less desires, less thinking that we're caught in. So the principle I'm trying to say here is there's a North Star, there's a guide that we can use in this practice. And it's a guide that leads us not towards an all or nothing result, but we're moving in a good direction. And the direction is a quieting of the mind, stilling of the mind, slowly. The direction is to not be so involved in our thoughts. The direction is to not be caught up in desires. Direction is to be able to identify and recognize when we have desires, when we're caught in them, and realize there is an alternative, and move towards the alternative. And one of the alternatives is to be clearly aware, to recognize what's happening. Oh, here's a desire. And you can experiment and find, how is it that I could be mindful of having thoughts, mindful of having a desire, and in the very act of awareness, the energy begins to quiet, the energy begins to decrease that goes into the desiring, into the thoughts. What is it? So what moved me in that direction? What, you know? And maybe it just means that I talk to myself a little more kindly. Or maybe I adjust the volume of the thinking. Or maybe I say, there, it's okay. It's okay to be thinking so much. And just that helps. Or maybe it's a very simple, clear, nothing extra recognition. Oh, I'm thinking. With no judgment, no for or against. Just, oh, this is what... And that moves the mind to a quieter place. And so slowly, over time, and sometimes it takes a while if you keep meditating regularly, someday you might start getting close. You might move towards closer and closer to the place where there's no desire. And if you follow this in a healthy way, you'll be so nourished by this. You'll be fed, you'll be open, you'll touch a tremendous beauty that lives in us, that's obscured by all the thoughts and all the desires and all the fears that we have. And so this settling, coming to that place of no desire, there's no toll there. But you get to be rich. Just like Mulla Nasruddin and his donkeys. And one of the reasons I like the story of the donkey is the donkey is, I don't know exactly, I don't want to be careful not to insult the donkeys. But donkeys are so ordinary and nothing special and they're not the stallion, you know, and they're the poor person's animal, and you know, nothing much, and so, you know, in that way, maybe you'll get rich, allowing your inner life to be a happy donkey. nothing special, nothing to prove, nothing to be, just happy to go, and the border guards will let you just go right through. No toll. And bit by bit, you'll get rich. This inner wealth that comes with this practice. So, those are my thoughts this evening. So now, if you want to... Now you can protest about this thing about desire. Yes, please. But if you can use the mic, please.
Is it possible to have desire without any craving or any attachment? And if so, do you consider that class of cravingless desires a class of desires you would recommend us to drop in the same way you would recommend us to drop the other ones?
Okay, good question. So desires can be very, like, you know, easy, a dime a dozen. They just arise and they go, and it's like, you know, they just drift through and there's no power to them. Just, oh, it'd be nice to. I'd like to have something, you know. It's okay. And then they can come with greater compulsion, so craving or attachment or wanting or insistence. Yes, it is possible to have desires without any compulsion, any insistence, any attachment. And that can be pretty good. However, it still involves mental work. And it's not the place of no desire. And so it's meditation allows you to go deeper and deeper and deeper. So at least in meditation, you know, in a few other situations in life, you can go maybe to a deep, deep place where even those desires, even the innocent desires, are no longer operating. But in ordinary life, it's quite nice to be very relaxing, but satisfying. To be able to see desires go through without any ripple in the mind, without any agitation in the mind, just kind of an ordinary agitation. I think I'd like an ice cream, but... You know, that was it. Does it make sense? Does that answer your question, or do you want to ask again or clarify? That's good enough? Yes.
The desires are of two kinds. There's craving and there's aspiration. And every desire I've seen, it's a mix of these two phenomena. There's no perfect craving desire and perfect aspirational desire. And I've noticed this, for example, when I'm looking for a job, I tend to make a spreadsheet, like work-life balance, salary, and all this. And after this, I feel enervated, drained of energy. And sometimes when you talk to somebody about an aspect of problem that they need to be solved in this job that you're looking for, you suddenly lighten up because you see through the entire thing, and irrespective of the company culture or whatever, it is just the joy of the problem and everything else falls away. So that seems to be more aspirational and independent of the salary and everything. What I've seen happen is I tend to get concentrated. So at the end of this, a lot of joy comes. Just the thought that there is such a problem, and if you join that place, you can solve this problem. Just that everything else drops off. I've seen that the sense of ego goes away, and it's just fun for the sake of it. And at the end of it, this joy comes and I tend to get concentrated. And I sleep well that night too. So that doesn't seem to be a bad thing. So aspirational desires are not bad.
No, I don't want to say that automatically desires are bad. I hope that's not what you got across today. There are appropriate desires, there's great desires, there's noble desires, there's ignoble desires, there's terrible desires, there's desires I hope you never have. And there's a whole range, and some desires to act on them and live with them, there's appropriate, some that are noble desires are acted on in unskillful ways, in unhealthy ways. There's a lot of attachment, clinging, self-involved. There are noble desires that wonderful desires that are a joy to do and easy to do, and there's no attachment involved, but there can be a lot of energy behind them and a lot of engagement. It's a whole range. Desire is a whole range. But what you said in the beginning I found most interesting, and that is that they're mixed. And so sometimes there's more what you're calling aspirational desire, which is maybe the more healthy ones, and then the unhealthy desires, they're mixed. And that's often the case, that, you know, we're mixed bags. We have really good motivations. At the same time, you know, I want to help my neighbor who's sick, but I hope all the other neighbors notice how good I am. So you look at yourself and you have to see, well, there's mixed motivations here. So what do I do? One decision is to say, well, I'm such a terrible person to want everyone to think I'm great, so I'm just going to go and hide in my room until that passes away, and hopefully my neighbor gets well before I come out. You know, just I'm not going to act on it. And then your neighbor stays sick, and no one brings them food or helps. So a principle that I use is I look at kind of the percentage. So if it's 80% healthy aspiration and 10% or 20%, you know, like ego-driven or something else, I think it's unfortunate to sacrifice the 80% good for the 20%, if you allow me to say this quite right, bad. I mean, that's kind of like a terror. That's tragic. So sometimes I'll recognize if I have some unhealthy desires as part of it and say, I recognize you're there, but in spite of that, I'm going to go along because there's 80% is really good and I want to help someone. And then I'll deal with the 20% another time, or I'll look at it or try to reflect on it. So, but if it's 20% aspirational or good, a nice desire, and 80% not, then maybe I should not act on it, because then I'll probably make a mistake, or, you know, the benefits for the world probably are not be so great. So there, you know, evaluate, and it doesn't have to be all or nothing, and it's better not to be so heavy-handed in judging yourself because you have a little bit of ego. It's not a crime. It's not a crime to have an attachment, generally. So, you know, we say in Buddhism not to have any attachments, but it's not a crime to have it. So it's okay, as long as you don't act on the wrong ones. Does that make some sense? Okay. So, some of you want to go home. It's probably a good idea. This is not the time to ask you to sit here and have no desires. Now, my wish for you, desire I have, is you drive home safely, carefully, and my wish is you have a wonderful, safe, contented, satisfying sleep through the night. Thank you.